My name is Aram Gavor. I'm a professor at GW Law, and along with Leo Connor, we run the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group with the Society. Now is a momentous time and a sea of change in our space, ad law, and we're just very lucky to have such an esteemed panel that will endeavor to answer the big question, what is the future of administrative law? I'm especially happy because each of the panelists in their own right could be a keynote speaker, and have been indeed, and they're all together here today. So our moderator, who will introduce the discussions, is the Honorable Naomi Rao, who sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit since her appointment in March 2019. Before she was appointed by President Trump to the D.C. Circuit, she was also appointed by President Trump in 2017 to serve as the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs within the Office of Management and Budget, which, as many of you likely know, is the least known, most important office in the EOP. She clerked for Harvey Wilkinson III on the Fourth Circuit, Justice Thomas on the Supreme Court. She was a professor at the Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, where she also founded the C. Boyd and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. So please join me in welcoming Judge Rao, who will introduce the rest of our discussants and kick off our panel.
Great. Thanks so much, Aram, and thanks to Aram and Leo Connor for organizing this this terrific panel. So this is a pretty full room. So you all know administrative law is a hot topic, and many of us on this panel have been thinking about this since, I think, before it became cool. But speaking for myself, at least, I think administrative law is so important. I'm just going to say for a few reasons before we get to the panelists. So the administrative state poses the most serious challenge to constitutional government. It's unraveled the legislative powers of Congress with massive delegations of lawmaking authority to executive branch agencies. It's fractured the unitary executive, both through the creation of so-called independent agencies, but also, frankly, just by the sheer size and scope of the administrative state. And proponents of unfettered administration have also sought to sideline the courts with various deference doctrines, undermining the exercise of the judicial power to say what the law is. And that last piece, at least, is in retreat after the Supreme Court's decision in Loper Bright. So these constitutional questions are not just academic. As the regulatories are, at OIRA, I saw up close how the administrative state threatens individual liberty, not just economic liberty, but social and religious liberty. Overreaching and unnecessary regulations impose costs on the economy, stifle innovation, and make the American people less well off. And intrusive social regulations seek to dictate choices made by families about everything from what appliances to use to how to educate their children. So restoring limits on administration is vital to restoring constitutional government and the separation of powers, and it's vital to the individual liberty that our Constitution was designed to protect. And our panel today is going to focus on developments in administrative law and the future of administrative law, but I hope we're also going to discuss a little bit about what we can do outside the courts in Congress and the executive. So to discuss these issues and many others, we really have an all-star panel, and very esteemed bios are available in your materials. So I just want to briefly introduce them in the order that they'll be speaking. We're going to start with Philip Hamburger, who is a professor of law at Columbia Law School, and he's CEO of the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which litigates many challenges to the administrative state. Carrie Cogalese is professor of law and political science at Penn Law School, and he's also director of the Penn Program on Regulation. And Kat Mizell, a fellow Justice Thomas family member, is a judge in the Middle District of Florida. And then we have Paul Clement, who is a partner at Clement & Murphy. He was previously the Solicitor General of the United States, and he's litigated many important administrative and constitutional law cases, arguing more than 100 cases before the Supreme Court. And so with that, we'll kick it off with Professor Hamburger.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here and with these splendid colleagues up here. Thank you so much. Recent administrative decisions by the Supreme Court are, to put it mildly, very gratifying. They are gratifying for many, many reasons, but most fundamentally because they portend a brighter future. They do not end the administrative state, but they signal a profound change in direction. Change is possible, and that is wonderful. Now, what exactly do they do? First, the decisions puncture the administrative state's judicial pretensions. They take down its attempt to be a junior varsity judiciary. Apologies to Antonin Scalia for the use of his phrase. Jarczy secures your right to get into an Article III court. As put in Jarczy, matters concerning private rights may not be removed from Article III courts. Mind you, the Supreme Court never said anything other than that, but now they actually seem to mean it. Jarczy also protects your right to a jury. The phrase public rights, which is not in the Constitution and has no business in judicial opinions, will no longer magically defeat your Seventh Amendment jury right. Other cases, Axon, Cochran, and Corner Post, buttress your right to get into an Article III court. Axon, Cochran lets you go straight to a district court to challenge the constitutionality of an agency proceeding. You don't have to wait till the end of the unconstitutional proceedings, let's say 7 years or whatever it takes. Corner Post says that the APA's six-year statute of limitations, it is a statute of limitations for challenging regulations, does not begin until the plaintiff is injured, which means we can challenge a lot more regulations in court. Both cases reinforce your right to get into a real court. Loper Bright and Relentless end Chevron deference, what I like to call Chevron bias, because if you think about what happens when you get to court, it's just bias. They thereby protect your fundamental Article III, and I might add, though the court did not, your due process right to the independent judgment of each judge. Now, all of this is remarkable. The full implications will take years to unfold, and I hope to learn shortly just how it will unfold in a minute. It will all take years to unfold, but these cases deflate the judicial pretenses of the administrative state, and that is profoundly important. But that's not all. Second, the cases confine the administrative state's legislative power. Cargill, the Bumstock case, begins to limit agencies to their statutory authority. It's just a beginning because there's still no incentive to get agencies to comply with expectation they comply with statutes, but it's a good start. Loper Bright and Relentless bar rulemaking where statutory authorization is ambiguous, and that will greatly reduce unauthorized rulemaking. And Jarczy, of course, has implications for regulation through guidance. Jarczy will push agencies in the direction of bringing enforcement actions in real courts, not just in-house proceedings. And when an agency must enforce its policies in a real court, it won't be able to rely on guidance. And this can be illustrated by the NCLA's 2021 victory in SEC versus Spartan Securities. The judge instructed the jury that guidance is not binding, and then, of course, the jury follows that instruction, and that's excellent. So Jarczy will end the enforceability of regulatory guidance. Now, this is not to say there won't be a lot of evasions that we have to cut off along the way, but it's a move in the right direction. All of this amounts to the greatest setback to administrative power, at least since 1935, perhaps ever. Gary Lawson, I don't know if he's in the room. Are you there? There you are. Gary Lawson, yes, one of the leaders in this. Bravo, Gary. Gary has recounted the rise and rise of the administrative state, and I'm delighted with his help. We now can see the tipping point when it starts to fall and fall. Won't that be jolly? Of course, this is just the beginning. As Churchill said, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. And that puts me, forgive me, that puts me in a celebratory mood.
Woo! That was impressive.
So I have, here, I have the microphones down here. Wait, our distinguished colleagues are all. Yes, the glasses are full, but I want them to overflow, right? May our glasses all overflow. I have a toast, and the toast is the long one, to Jarkissi, to Axe and Cochran, to Corner Post, to Loper Bright, to Relentless, and all the other wonderful cases, and to all of you. To all of you who seek a revival of our constitutional freedoms, bravo.
Here, here. Here. Cheers.
Cheers.
To share, nor do I have a crystal ball, I should say, either. So I'm happy to talk about why I think it it may be a bit premature to celebrate what it means for administrative governance from the last term. But in terms of what it means for administrative law, when I read, and I'm going to focus my remarks principally on Loper Bright at the outset, when I read Loper Bright, I was reminded of a reaction to a prior decision related to Chevron, where it was said, and I quote, "We will be sorting out the consequences for years to come." And I think that is a fair statement of Loper Bright. The same observer indicated at an earlier time that the principal effect of this earlier decision will be protracted confusion. And this observer was Justice Scalia commenting on the Mead decision, writing in the dissent in 2001. And I think it's worth noting that even though the majority in Loper Bright criticized Chevron for creating a Byzantine doctrinal structure, or an intricate one, words that it used. And Chevron was widely criticized as confusing, itself ambiguous. Loper Bright actually, right now, leads to at least, I think, five ambiguities going forward. So I think for when we look at the future of administrative law, some resolution to the extent that there can be of these five ambiguities will be at the heart of what we'll be talking about for years to come. The first is, and this I think will be perennial, is what's the best reading of a statute? Loper Bright imposes upon judges that obligation to find the best reading of a statute. That itself is a challenging and contested a task, in perhaps inherently so. Second ambiguity going forward, might sometimes the best reading of a statute be one that affords the agency the authority or the policy discretion, however one might want to characterize it, to apply general or ambiguous terms in a statute to fill in gaps and silences. In other words, did Chevron really effectively disappear? Third ambiguity, what role will Skidmore play in the future? In his dissent in Mead, Justice Scalia said that the majority's approach compounds the confusion it creates by breathing new life into the anachronism of Skidmore. One might well say that of Loper Bright. Fourth, what is the retroactive effect of overruling Chevron? The Loper Bright majority said that it was not overruling or displacing prior agency actions decided under Chevron, but are the statutory interpretations that underlay those prior court-approved actions immune from future consideration or unraveling or reconsideration under a best reading standard? Will new litigants come forward, as Corner Post would permit, and now challenge the present or future application of those older interpretations? And fifth, and a final ambiguity, is what will come of Kaiser v. Wilkie? Justice Roberts in Kaiser made a point of noting that our deference, that is deference by the courts to agencies' interpretations of their own regulations, is different from Chevron deference. And our was upheld just a few years back with perhaps some modification. But really, can this distinction between our and Chevron really last? It's hard to see that. So that's another question going forward. These are just some of the more specific questions that I think follow from Loper-Bright directly. More broadly and indirectly, there are a much larger set of questions that Loper-Bright's overturning of a 40-year-old precedent, which had been one of the most cited of all Supreme Court decisions, and that is, if that precedent goes, what other precedents will disappear in the years ahead? In other words, perhaps the largest overarching ambiguity is how far will this court be going in altering and reconfiguring the structure of U.S. administrative law. So I end these opening remarks where I began by saying we will be sorting the consequences for years to come.
Thank you.
Judge Mizell?
Thank you, Judge Rao, for the kind introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate on this panel. I'd like to speak this afternoon about what I forecast to be the effect on district courts in light of the Supreme Court's recent cases, and then some areas that I think the district courts would welcome clarification. So one worry that was voiced in light of the past term's administrative law decisions was that there was a potential for a flood of litigation against the federal government. In her dissent in Corner Post, Justice Jackson warned that the court's decision there, and in combination with Loper-Bright, might have authorized a, quote, tsunami of suits against federal agencies that have the potential to devastate the functioning of the federal government. Another recent article opined that Loper-Bright was likely to lead to a dramatic increase in litigation such that there might be a necessary expansion of the federal bench to absorb it. From my view as a district court judge, I'm not convinced that the recent decisions will work such devastating consequences on either the federal judiciary or the federal government. A little background about my district might help put in perspective why I'm of that view. So I sit on the Middle District of Florida, which is the second largest judicial district in the country when measured by population, second only to Central District of California, that of course includes LA. When you look at our caseload, our mean average civil case filings each year is over 8,600 cases. For perspective, the average median, mean, for federal district courts across the country is about 1,600. So it's a big district, big civil docket. So what I did is I pulled the APA filings for the last decade from my court to see what are the trends. I was surprised. after you exclude for Social Security appeals, and you look for just what I would call a true APA case, on average, the last decade, my court had eight APA cases a year out of the 8,600 filed annually. since 2015, the most we've had in one year was 2021, and that's when we had our high water mark of 26 non-Social Security APA cases. Now, I looked at all of those. 15 of them were appeals from USCIS, so things for like denials of application for green cards. That means there were less than one true APA case per active judge in my district in the high water mark year. Now, I offer these figures to show that even in busy district courts, I don't think the federal judiciary is inundated with APA cases, and it certainly can absorb whatever wave the recent Supreme Court decisions might encourage. And of course, I recognize that there are district courts across the country who receive an outsized number of APA cases, such as DDC, maybe Northern District of Texas, and perhaps again, Northern District of California. But I don't think those are the norm, and nor do I think APA challenges generally are causing any sort of judicial crisis. Okay, second point I was making was that I don't anticipate devastating effects for the administrative functioning of the government either. Although the concern that was raised in the Corner Post dissent focused on facial challenges to administrative actions long after the action might have occurred and therefore upsetting regulated entities' expectations, realistically, most agency action is challenged pretty shortly after it's taken. So take, for example, again, the year 2021 in my court, where we had the most. Those 9 non-immigration APA cases almost all had to do with COVID. And that is to be expected. Right after the COVID regulations occurred, they were challenged. I don't think there's anything unusual about that. Take another example recent for my district court. So after the FTC announced its non-compete rule in late spring, a real estate broker brought a challenge, pre-enforcement challenge, before the rule was set to go into effect in September, seeking a preliminary injunction to which that plaintiff got. That's the ordinary, or I didn't say always, but it is a very common administrative law posture. And I flag that simply to say, as courts adjudicate APA challenges to new agency action, which normally occurs shortly thereafter, precedent will bind the later litigants, even litigants who might not have existed at the time that the decision was rendered. So all said, I do not suspect that Corner Post or Loper-Bright is going to debilitate the administrative functioning of the federal government. Going forward, I think district courts across the country would welcome some clarification on APA remedies, and in particular, vacatur. So, although the Supreme Court has affirmed decisions that have the effect of affirming a vacatur type of remedy, they've never directly addressed whether 7062 language of set aside means to vacate. Of course, I had to confront this language when I had the Health Freedom Defense Fund v. Biden case, commonly known as the mass mandate case. There, the plaintiff association had sought for me to set aside, that's the word they used, but they meant vacate, the CDC's rule that you had to wear a mask on all public transportation. When fashioning the final judgment in the case, I wasn't working as a matter of first impression. The 11th Circuit has told me that vacatur is the ordinary APA remedy, and that is certainly consistent with other circuits across the court or across the country, including the DC Circuit. But like I said, the Supreme Court has never definitively held what 7062 means. Certainly there are strong indications from Justice Gorsuch, Thomas, and Barrett on one side that says as a statutory interpretation method or manner, the 7062 doesn't contemplate vacatur. And then obviously in his recent opinion in Corner Post, Justice Kavanaugh took the opposite view. There has been some, I think, discussion post this term about amendments to the APA that Congress might make. And so I suppose it's possible that they could clarify what they mean by set aside, articulate whether they intended to create a quote new form of legal action under 703 that came with this new remedy, a vacate. That's possible, but to me, all of that kind of begs the bigger question, which is whether vacating a rule or regulation is consistent with the Article III judicial power. So, as a district court judge, I think I'm routinely going to be asked by litigants to do this, and I think these issues are going to continue to percolate up to the Supreme Court. So, additional academic research, I think, would be useful on questions that relate to whether that is consistent with Article III. The Supreme Court has said that when federal courts are sitting in equity, that they must ordinarily trace their remedies to those that were administered by the English Court of Chancery at the time of the separation of the two countries. So to me, then, we need to look at that time period and see, was there anything like a quasi-legislative, quasi-executive agency that promulgated rules, and what sort of powers did federal courts have in issuing final judgments related to those rules? I highlight this particular debate for two reasons. Like I said, one, this is the normal remedy that APA litigants are seeking. They want the whole rule invalidated, usually. And two, most of these APA-styled actions come with some sort of emergency relief request, a stay of the rule or a preliminary injunction. It's been well discussed now, right? The rush that causes all the way from the district court up to the Supreme Court in terms of the emergency docket that sees these kinds of cases. if the Supreme Court were to clarify whether 7062 authorizes vacatur or otherwise determines that it is not compatible with Article 3, I think you'd see a dramatic decrease in these emergency filings. And I certainly think the absence of universal vacatur would greatly reduce any disruption to the administrative state and to the functioning of like an administration's top priorities. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Paul?
Thank you, Judge. And it's great to be here with my fellow panelists and the widow Clicquot. So thank you for that, Professor. I'm going to start with a bit of a confession. It turns out it's true. I didn't always want Chevron to be overruled. When I was a law clerk on the D.C. Circuit in 1992, and the options available to the court were to defer to the Bush administration or to apply a D.C. Circuit decision by Skelly Wright or David Bazelon, the wisdom of the Chevron doctrine seemed to be pretty clear to me. And of course, as a young conservative lawyer, I read what Justice Scalia had to say about the Chevron doctrine. And his basic justification, I think, came down to a pretty simple and pretty sensible proposition, which is if you really had an ambiguous statute, and if you applied Justice Scalia's textualism, you'd rarely have a truly ambiguous statute. But if you actually had a truly ambiguous statute, and your only choices were to defer to, essentially an unelected, non-responsive judiciary, or to a minimally responsive executive branch official who at least sort of employed the power coming from the president who was elected and was responsive to the people, as between those two choices, you were better off deferring to the minimally accountable executive branch. And that all made a lot of sense to me. And I will certainly tell you, when I found myself in the Solicitor General's office during the Bush 43 administration, and was charged with defending various government regulations and actions, Chevron seemed like an awesome idea. And I will say, if you go back to the briefs that were filed during that period, the embrace of Chevron by the Bush administration was unambiguous. This was not some sort of, we're begrudgingly applying this doctrine because it helps the executive. It was kind of gleefully invoked during that period of time. So my own kind of disenchantment with Chevron really required me to kind of watch the doctrine over time. And what I became convinced of is that among its many other failings that others had focused on, what really became clear to me, and maybe it's because I spent 2 years working on the Hill at one point, but it became clear to me that kind of classic sort of Scalia, let's just compare the unelected judiciary with the minimally responsive executive, ignored the effects on the other branch of government, the Congress. And over time, and particularly if you could witness what happened in changes of administration, especially after the Obama administration, that took real advantage of the ability to change policy through executive rulemaking, you started to see two things happen that seemed very pernicious to me. One is the incentives for Congress to actually legislate and do anything were substantially eroded. Because if you just think about the basic math, at any time, about half of the people in Congress have friends in the executive branch. And so if for about half the people in Congress, there's really not a lot of incentive to compromise and agree to enduring legislation, because you can get essentially everything you want, at least in certain areas of the law, just by calling up your friends in the executive branch and saying, look, I don't want all the heat back in my district for actually compromising on this. I do want a good result. Why don't you guys just do it through executive action? And I think that has had a debilitating effect on the Congress. And then, of course, it has the second effect, which you really see over time, which is on important issues, instead of coming to an enduring compromise that doesn't change with each administration, you really start sort of ping-ponging from one policy to the other essentially every 4 years. And indeed, in some of these areas, if the litigants are clever enough, they can keep the first administration's policy tied up in the courts for the whole 4 years, and it never actually goes into effect. We saw that in the Clean Power Act context, for example. And it seems to me that also is not, the system is not designed to have essentially the primary rules of conduct change radically every 4 years in kind of a non-enduring way. So because of those issues, you know, I'd long tried to, in various cases, take a whack here, big whack sometimes, a small whack other times, at the Chevron doctrine. But most of my experience had been in the context of representing the Chevrons of the world, or Amalgamated Chemical, other litigants that just don't sort of create a huge amount of sympathy. And then one day out of the blue, a couple of years ago, my friends at Cause of Action called and told me about a sort of obscure case involving the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And the facts of this case as they related to me instantly grabbed my attention. And the facts, as many of you know, but I'll just give them in a nutshell, is that Congress, in its wisdom, has decided that for these relatively small fishing vessels, they have to, at the government's request, give up one of the spaces on the ship to a government monitor, whose role is not to help bring in the catch, but just to monitor to make sure the Byzantine federal regulations that apply to the fisheries are abided by the fishers. Now that's, for better or for worse, that's Congress. But what Congress didn't provide for is who's going to pay for these pesky monitors on the ship. And the agency, having run out of appropriations, decided that, well, we're going to, by regulation, decide that the fishermen should pay for the monitors that are on their ships taking up precious space. And this struck me as essentially the perfect case to take on Chevron, because here, the problems of Chevron are not being visited on the Chevrons of the world, the Amalgamated Chemicals, but on small business people. And it is small business people, it's frankly immigrants, Social Security applicants, and others, that bear a lot of the practical costs, the immediate costs of the Chevron doctrine. Now, you know, my theory of litigation is you try to provide the courts with as many possible ways for your client to win as humanly possible. So when we presented this to the Supreme Court, we presented two questions presented, as was done in the Relentless case as well. The first question being, you know, under this particular act, isn't this crazy? And the second one, you know, should you consider overruling or substantially limiting the Chevron doctrine? I will say, you know, courts constantly surprise me, but one of the most surprising things that happened to me recently is when the court granted cert limited to question two. So the court put front and center the continuing existence of the Chevron doctrine. They added the Relentless case, I think making clear that might be odd to overrule a six-justice decision with an eight-justice court, so it might be good to have a case that Justice Jackson hadn't touched on the D.C. Circuit as well before the court. And all of those signals led to the court and a set of arguments that really focused on the continuing existence of the Chevron doctrine. And then, of course, we got the decision that contains my three favorite words of the year: Chevron is overruled. Now, in terms of just talking about how important that's going to be, I mean, I think that the judge provides an important perspective that, you know, not everybody's docket is full of sort of Chevron cases and the like. But I do think this is an incredibly consequential decision. And if anybody tells you otherwise, please remind them of the word that the Solicitor General used in telling the Supreme Court that they shouldn't overrule Chevron, because if they did, the consequences would be, quote, convulsive. Now, I think that's a great word. I think everybody here who's got a case against the government where the government is saying that the overruling of Chevron doesn't change the result and doesn't mean that the government has a problem should remind the government of the word convulsive. Word of the day. The second thing I think is going to make this important, and many people have alluded to this, but just to highlight it, is the Corner Post decision. Because as I alluded to, back in the Bush administration, I think in the early Obama administration, nobody was being particularly subtle about relying on the Chevron doctrine. Now, in more recent days, because some people in the executive branch could sort of see the writing on the wall, you would have cases where the administration, the executive branch, would actually not invoke Chevron in terms. They might try to still get some deference, but they didn't want to, like, use the C word. And so some of the very recent regulations It's a little harder to say, okay, this is a really big, dramatic, convulsive change. But because the corner post decision allows you to kind of reach back and challenge older rules that are now in the modern day, essentially goring somebody's ox anew, that decision allows you to reach back to some of these rules where if you go into the administrative record, it's just clear as day. This is a Chevron case. We think we can do this, or we think we can change our position because of Chevron and Brand X. And so I do think the combination of those two factors is going to be very important. Let me just say one word about the future as kind of a transition, because the other thing I wanted to say about this is, you know, as a doctrinal matter, I think this is a big deal. I think corner post will act as something of an accelerant and make it an even bigger deal. But one of the best things to ever happen to the movement to try to cut back on the administrative state was the Biden administration. Because in many, many areas, the Biden administration pushed the envelope, they overreached. And I will tell you, in my own view, in a way that was distinct from the Obama administration, they didn't even care that much if they were going to win in court. Because if they pushed the envelope and lost, at least they tried, and their friends on the Hill would give them full credit for trying to do the good thing, trying to regulate something that they didn't actually have the authority to regulate. So unlike the Obama administration, where my experience was if you went into a meeting and you could really convince them that if you do this, you're going to lose, they might trim their sails. I didn't have that experience in the Biden administration. So the Biden administration was a real gift. And the question is, how does a change to the Trump administration affect that? And that is something that I'm trying to figure out right now on behalf of any number of clients. And I will tell you, some of my clients are not so sure that what they want to have happen is to have the bad regulation go away, just so it can come back in 4 or 8 years. They almost want to take this snapshot of this particular overreach and see if perhaps this might not be the way to get a definitive ruling about whether the executive has, in fact, tried to exercise an authority that just doesn't exist. So I think the next couple of months will be fascinating to see which regulations are pulled, which regulations are continued in force, who's going to intervene where to defend what, are they going to be allowed to intervene, do they have standing to intervene? I think all of those questions are going to be a big part of the future of administrative law in the next couple of months.
Great. Well, thank you so much. All our panelists. We will eventually be opening up for some audience questions, but first, I have some questions for our panelists. We've been talking a lot about the courts and litigation, and obviously there's been a big sea change over the last few years, but I'm wondering if any of the panelists would like to talk about how some of these legal developments might affect what Congress and the executive should do or what they can do in ways to bring the administrative state closer to the Constitution.
May I have a whack at that?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. Yeah, that's going to be very interesting in the coming months, won't it? So I should say there's something I don't know. I don't really know what the new President Trump thinks about the administrative state. I know he doesn't like the deep state, but what does he think about the administrative state? In my view, the administrative state is actually the deepest state. It's not as obviously the deep state, but it is just as opposed to one perspective. And so my hope is that President Trump will recognize that it is the deepest state. If he doesn't, what I think we'll get is a lot of regulatory reform and no structural change. And that would be a disaster because, frankly, we need to revive our constitutional limits on government. Now, if the president understood that the administrative state is the deepest state, there are 1,000 things he could do. I'll just mention a few. He could ask agencies in an orderly way, one by one, to send their regulations to Congress for enactment. I think that would be very wholesome. He could order government lawyers not to seek any judicial deference under any doctrine on the grounds that that's soliciting a violation of due process, in other words, judicial bias. One of my favorites, he could declare all regulatory guidance to be final agency action, right? You know, if you think about the effects of Loper-Bright, you know, an agency can go high or low. It can play the high card by just looking for statutory authorization, or I can take the low route, right, and just increase guidance, regulatory guidance. So it seems to me regulatory guidance, which really does operate in most instances as final agency action, we shouldn't kid ourselves about that, should be declared as such so we can do something about it. He could order agencies to bring regulatory enforcement actions only in the courts, not in-house. In other words, take the jarcossy principle seriously. And if he wants to work with Congress, and I do hope that happens, he could seek a new Civil Rights Act, and we could all have our favorite list of what would go in it. I'll just mention mine. Title I would be against government censorship. Title II, against private participation in government censorship. Title III, against viewpoint-based debanking. And Title IV, against common carrier deplatforming on the basis of viewpoint. Just some thoughts. I'm sure people will disagree with some of this, but we do have a civil rights issue at stake here, and perhaps it's time for a new Civil Rights Act.
Any other thoughts about what the executive or Congress can do?
Well, if I'm remembering correctly, wasn't there in the last Trump administration, the idea that OIRA would only approve one reg if you got rid of one or something like
yes.
that? You could do a two for one, so you have to get rid of regulations
right.
to
so
pass
the president issued an executive order two for one. Actually, after the first year, we did 11 for one. So, yeah, it was quite a lot of government efficiency, you know. yeah, but there are a lot of... you know, Justice Gorsuch talked about this a little bit last night. There are a lot of different procedural structural changes that would make things better in terms of guidance. And we did a lot of that in the first Trump administration, but a lot of that was reversed by the last administration, which I think goes to Paul's point, which is that a lot of these changes are not very enduring, both with respect to substantive policy, but also with respect to procedural rules.
And that's where I think, you know, there's a real opportunity here if it is, in fact, seized, tried to... not just do the reform unilaterally in the executive branch, but to take a moment where there's at least nominal control of both houses, and to try to really try to legislate in a way. And that can take so many forms. I mean, as the professor was saying, it can take the form of some kind of more comprehensive effort to deal with these problems, but it also can just... you know, if they're regs that everybody think make sense as legislation, then why not pass them as legislation? You know, this idea that it's impossible for Congress to do this or Congress doesn't have the resources, they can take, you know, I mean, the Constitution certainly gives the president the authority to recommend legislation, and they can just take the regs in certain areas as recommended legislation and they could pass it. Now, I think in most of these areas, they won't pass it as is. And this gets to this point about the difference between the truly representative branch and the minimally representative executive branch. I mean, if you think about what, just to use Loper as an example, if you think about the compromise or the judgment that the executive branch made, it was a judgment only the executive branch could make, which is all these people, no matter how small the business, we regulate them and they'll pay. And Congress in the same statute actually looked at this. And it actually provided for the payment of monitors in three limited circumstances. The three limited circumstances were the most profitable fishery in the country in the Pacific Northwest on the judgment that they could afford to pay. But when Congress did that, they still put a strict limit that was only 2% of the catch that they would have to pay. The next one was if you get a special permit that allows you to fish in circumstances where you otherwise wouldn't, then you can pay for your monitor. And again, it was capped as a percentage of the catch. And in the third context, the only context in which they allowed this kind of paying for monitoring without any cap was when foreign fisher people who don't vote in U.S. elections are allowed gratuitously to fish in U.S. waters. Now, that's what a Congress does. They take into account that, like, if I start taxing small business people, I'm going to get killed. If I put what is really a tax on a big company that can afford to pay it subject to a cap, maybe I won't get killed. If I put it on foreign fishermen, I'm going to have no problem at all. I mean, but those are the kind of judgments you want. So if you actually took some of these regs and sort of made them into legislation, I think they would change in ways that would actually help illustrate some of the problems with the administrative state.
Can I come and just
yeah?
If I can just follow up on that, I think that's a very important point. The NCLA handled the Relentless case, which was the parallel case with Loper Bright. And I think you're absolutely right, Paul. The outcomes would be shifted slightly. And that's wholesome, because however rational the administrators are, there is this danger, which your comments illustrate, of class bias. And we don't normally divide ourselves by class in this country, but the administrative state builds in authority in the most privileged class in this country, us, right? We have false consciousness. But if we were true to our class interest, we would support the administrative state because it's the power of the educated. And people who work with their hands, as these people do, just get screwed. And that cannot be the way we're governed in a republic. So I agree entirely.
Some more maybe banal speculations or forecasts about what might happen with other branches. I think most immediately you will see the invocation of the Congressional Review Act again to disapprove regulations that were promulgated toward the end of the Biden administration. So that's, I think, a given. The question is whether Congress will pass the RAINS Act now. I think a lot will depend on what the Senate does with the filibuster rule. And this is why, again, I don't have a crystal ball. I wouldn't proclaim to. In fact, I have a forthcoming paper in the Administrative Law Review with Dan Walters at the Texas A&M Law School, in which we argue that the real consequences from, in particular, Loper Bright, but I think even more generally here from the shift that the court has undertaken is hard to forecast and will depend upon how other actors play a very complex game called the administrative governance game. And this is also a long-term game too. So there may be changes that occur over the next 4 years in the Trump administration. Will there be a sustainment of those changes after that time? We really can't tell that for sure. I mean, I think there are again questions also about how the courts will respond to actions taken by the executive branch and perhaps Congress in the future. I mean, in the first Trump administration, there were a number of judicial decisions that sort of sent back Trump actions on arbitrary and capricious grounds. The Supreme Court in the Department of Commerce versus New York case rejected the Trump administration's desire to make some changes to the census, for example, under the arbitrary and capricious standard, and I think we'll have to see where that goes. The old concurrence that Justice Rehnquist offered in the MVMA, Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association versus State Farm case, in which he offered that a change in administration would be a factor or a reason for justifying, under the arbitrary and capricious standard, a change in administrative policy. Well, we'll have to see what the court might do with that. That's a possibility in the future. To the extent that the president-elect carries forward on a rhetoric of his to target enemies within, perhaps with selective deployment of administrative power, there may be due process questions that come to the fore in those cases. I do think that on the one hand, I agree with Professor Hamburger's earlier remarks that there has been a big shift with this last term in our cases, a big shift that has tended to move a lot of decision making from administrative agencies, at least qualitatively, into the courts. Jarkissi disapproving certain adjudications by agencies and saying they have to be handled by the courts. Loper Bright saying deference of a certain kind now needs to be eliminated, and courts need in their first instance to give their best reading. Corner post, expanding the options to get into the courts. This is all, certainly indicative of a shift. But it's also worth noting what, in some sense, didn't happen this last term. What didn't happen was Chevron was not overruled on constitutional grounds, but on statutory grounds. Jarkissi had lifted up the possibility of revisiting the non-delegation doctrine and for cause protections for adjudicators, but the court didn't bite on those issues. The court resoundingly, really, in a 7-2 decision, rejected a challenge to under the appropriations clause to the funding of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and it also resoundingly denied standing to challengers to the FDA's approval of mifepristone. So a lot of, I think, what will happen in the future is hard to know, because not only are there the other players and what they will do, whether the filibuster will stand, for example, whether administrative actions of the executive branch will take one form or another, but it will also depend on, really, again, how far the court will go. And this past term, you can either look at it as some kind of tectonic shift, and some people do, or you could look at it as, well, maybe a more incremental change, and begging the question of, well, how much more change might lie ahead? And we'll have to see.
Hey, we have one more question, and then we'll open up to questions if people want to come to the mics. So like Judge Mizell, I'm interested in this question of remedies, both as a practical matter and actually as a theoretical matter. And I'm wondering if the panelists want to say a little bit about remand without vacater, whether vacating is appropriate under the APA, and what do you think about this thought that when courts, including the D.C. Circuit, use the term vacate, they're just sort of putting an emphasis on set aside? This has a lot of consequences, right? I mean, if courts have to find the best meaning, then what are we supposed to do with that meaning?
Right. On vacatur and set aside, I have all sorts of thoughts. And one of them is, of course, vacatur is not what the APA alludes to. It simply says set aside, and that can be understood in multiple ways. And some of them are more worrisome, perhaps, than others. And it seems to me, in saying set aside, there's one meaning which at least one can attribute to it. I think one has to attribute to it, because there's a limited degree to which a statute can interfere with the judiciary's decision about the consequences of its judgment, right? So at the very least, a court, if it finds a regulation or some other agency action unlawful, it therefore is void, it's without obligation, and a court should say as much. And of course, a court could never actually vacate some underlying judgment or agency action. You can't go in and scrub it out of the books, right? Is Jonathan Mitchell here? He would tell us you can't do that, right? But nonetheless, the decision that something's unlawful means it is void in the sense of devoid of obligation, and that should have immediate effect, right? But I thought Kennedy's concurrence in Corner Post was very, very important. He points out that there's no remedy for downstream plaintiffs who are injured by a regulation, because if they can't get vacater, because they can't get an injunction. And if I may just, I hope this isn't too much of a distraction, but I want to say this is part of a larger problem, I think, on the Supreme Court at the moment. They're not paying enough attention to remedies and what's available. And this is very, very worrisome. This is part of the qualified immunity problem. And I just want to give one example of this, which came up in Murthy versus Missouri. What is the message of, this is the censorship case, and obviously NCLA was involved in this. There's no reliable remedy for past censorship because of qualified immunity. You just can't go after past censorship for damages. There's no effective remedy for future censorship because injunctions are too narrow. An injunction protecting, let's say, me does not protect the millions of other people who have been censored. And government always can evade even an injunction, let's say, for Jay Bhattacharya, by simply just saying, oh, we're no longer going after him, and poof, your injunction remedy disappears. And then when you add in heightened standing requirements about particularized traceability concocted just for this case, there is no remedy for future censorship. So I don't think the Supreme Court ever paused to ask, what is the remedy for censorship? And I think currently there is no effective remedy if we take their decision seriously. I hope they don't. I hope they take the law seriously on this.
I mean, I'll just, echo that in the following. I'm going to echo what you just said, and then I'm in a slightly different context, and then I'm going to go right to the issue of sort of vacature without remand, where, angels fear to tread. So on just this question about, the remedies being so important, and sometimes the court maybe not taking a close enough look at them. I mean, if you think about the story of separation of powers litigation over the last decade, it's largely a story of litigants who win their Supreme Court case and get no relief whatsoever. I mean, Free Enterprise Fund, Celia Law, there are all of these cases where they, vindicate the Constitution at great personal expense and lawyers' fees and inconvenience, but then the court says, well, but this was just a removal restriction, and we'll just leave everything that you were complaining about in place. And, that's not a healthy place to leave the law. I mean, it's probably true that you can get people to argue Supreme Court cases for nothing, but you can't actually get people to bring lower court challenges for nothing. And so if you set up a system where you're not providing robust remedies for separation of powers violations or administrative law violations, then, I think it you're not going to get enough of them. And I also think you may get the wrong ones. So I think that is a really important issue. On the thing that, in my mind, that makes sort of the vacature without remand, or remand without vacature, rather, issue kind of a difficult one is, there are plenty of situations where the entity that is messed up is the agency, and the entity that's going to pay the price for that error if the administrative action is vacated is the proponent of like an infrastructure project or something where the problem is a perceived NEPA violation. And so, the person who's trying to invest lots of capital in some project hasn't done anything wrong. They weren't responsible for doing the NEPA analysis. They didn't look at the right thing. But if, as a result of some perceived footfall in the NEPA analysis, the agency action is vacated, then the party who's going to pay the price for that isn't the agency that messed up. It's going to be the person who's invested millions, if not billions, in capital in the project that can only meaningfully go forward if there is timely approval and the approval actually means an approval. And just as an anecdote in another context, but I think it brings up the same point. I've had two Supreme Court cases that vindicated my client's legal argument that allowed a pipeline to go forward. And in both of those cases, the pipeline was ultimately scrapped and didn't go forward, even though they took the case all the way to the Supreme Court and won, because the particular issue that got to the Supreme Court was just one of 10 regulatory approvals that they needed. And the challengers were going to challenge all 10 of them. And the challengers won essentially the war of attrition. So to me, one of the things that I think I think this kind of idea that you can remand without vacature, I guess there's one of two things in my mind. I mean, either that is a permissible option because it does provide a mechanism for, somebody not to pay a very significant price for an error that wasn't theirs. Or if the real remedy has to be set aside or vacature, then I think there has to be greater room for kind of notions of harmless error. Because I think you do really have to take into account the consequences of vacature or set aside, not just for the agency, but for the regulated parties as well.
Can I add some thoughts on this? So I do think that there would be great value to clarification from the Supreme Court or circuit courts thinking conceptually about the APA generally. So I've written a little bit on this. You have, right, on two sides of this debate, what does set aside mean? You have Professor Harrison, Professor Bomzai saying it just means don't enforce the law as, or the rule with regards to that party, that kind of thing. But I think, and then on the other side, you have like Professor Bremer who says, no, it's like an appellate style review type of analysis. But I think if we take a step back and look at the APA generally, you look at 703, right? It says you have judicial review for forms of legal action. And what did that mean in the 1940s, like forms of legal action? And it lists some, right, in 703. It like says declaratory judgment, injunction. And so it's like, was that the form of the action that was being brought? And then that naturally brings with it the remedy, right? You get an injunction, you get a declaratory judgment. Or was the APA creating some new form and 706-2 set aside as a vacate or whatever the remedy is. And you can argue about whether it's been liquidated in the last 80 years or not. But I think that's like a fundamental question that I've never seen litigants even think about, right? Like when you look at an APA styled complaint, you have APA, you know, arbitrary capricious claim, count two, APA exceeds the agency authority, count three, some other, but it's not asking for a form of relief tied to each of these counts, if that makes sense. And at the very end, when it seeks, you know, the relief, it says vacate the whole rule for all these different sorts of APA violations. But it's not conceptualizing it in the way that I think there's some work to be done as to what is the APA doing. Was it just codifying what existed as a matter of administrative law in the 1940s? Was it creating something new? If it was codifying something, was there a form of vacatur at that time? So I think those are questions that would warrant a lot of further investigation.
More student law note comment ideas.
Yes, there.
From the judge, yeah. Okay, so why don't we open it up to audience questions? Let's start over here. And if I could just remind all the questioners to please ask a question and be succinct. Thank you.
Sure, so another question about remedy. If you look at, for example, the class action context where they really started out, like Brown v. Board started as a class action where you need one solution that fits for everyone because a school can't be half segregated and half not, right? So my question is, do you think that the All Writs Act would empower federal courts to basically tell the government, you broke the law, money damages don't really work, we can't really deter you for the reasons Professor Hamburger said, unless we just order you to not do this in the future and stop, especially if it's a continuing harm, as opposed to just, for example, passing, you know, running a red light once. Well, you might not do it again, but if the harm is ongoing, you have to tell the government to stop. So is that a relevant tool at all?
Say like a writ of mandamus?
A writ like that. And from what I understand, if you can use the All Writs Act to force Apple, deputize them, hack their own phones for the DOJ, then why can't you tell the DOJ to stop doing illegal things using the All Writs Act as well? I mean, isn't it kind of an open tool? And so is the APA really the statute that's necessary? Or do we already have a statute or underlying equitable judicial principle that would let the courts that have both law and equity jurisdiction to solve the problem without arguing about vacatur?
I will say that the problem you describe is a real one in the administrative state. It's one that actually administrative law scholars have talked about for many years under the context of agency acquiescence or non-acquiescence, because if you think about you don't have to go to Brown v. Board of Education. You just go to something like the Social Security Administration and its computer systems that have to be programmed, reprogrammed. Do they apply somewhat differently in one circuit than another circuit? There's a real need sometimes for administrative agents, just a practical need to have some degree of uniformity. And agencies have been grappling with this for a long time. I think it's the courts now starting to wake up and see that there may be need to grapple with this as well. Congress has tried to actually address this in some instances. Many of the major environmental statutes have mandatory venue provisions for nationally applicable environmental regulations, so they have to go to the D.C. Circuit so that there is some degree of uniformity. And, you know, maybe if we're looking to the future and making recommendations, it's not just, again, as Judge Rao said, to the up to the courts, really, to define the future of administrative law. But this might be an area for Congress to clarify what set aside means in Section 706 of the APA, or to in situations where there is a difficulty to split the baby to put in more mandatory venue provision.
I have a question.
Sure, thank you. This is just more of a prediction question, but Mr. Clement, you sort of represented why Justice Scalia liked Chevron step two, but where the court has exhausted all of the tools of statutory construction and can't get to a single right answer, isn't the third option to just rule that the statute is unconstitutional because it's an excessive delegation of legislative power? And how do you see that argument, how do you see the non-delegation argument, I guess, playing out in court? Do you think it's going to be something that your clients, you know, might be able to rely on in the next 5-10 years or something like that?
So, I mean, you know, look, I think there are some situations where, you know, the reason that you can't sort of figure out what a statute means is because it sort of means nothing or it means too much and there's a delegation problem. There are also situations, though, when, you know, you exhaust all of the tools of statutory construction and it's a heck of a problem. It's a heck of a statute, you know. Affordable Care Act, whatever you want. Like, I mean, you know, there are statutes that were drafted in a hurry. They're a mess, and you sort of get to the end of it, and there's really not a delegation problem. Now, I think in those circumstances, the answer that Loper provides is work harder. Like, dust off some Latin canon that nobody's heard of in 30 years. But don't quit, and don't just say, at a certain point, this gets tough, so I'm going to go with the government. I mean, gee whiz, if, you know, and one of the points that sort of struck a lot of people about Chevron is if you really did get to a point where you couldn't tell whether the government should win or the citizen should win, like why in the world wouldn't the rule be go with the citizen? But I think the rule that emerges from Loper is that you just have to work harder in most contexts because most hard statutory questions don't really have a lot to do with sort of delegation. Now, there are going to be some contexts where, you know, if you put Justice Scalia alone in a room with the words public interest, you know, I don't know that he would say, oh, public interest means this. I think he would say, like, what's going on here? This isn't a proper sort of delegation. But even Justice Scalia would say, I don't know, man, we got to do better than the intelligible principles doctrine. So I think one of the challenges that lies ahead is for people in this room and others to come up with something that has more of an intelligible principle than the intelligible principles doctrine.
Can I just say, as a matter of having to interpret a lot of these thorny statutes for most of my job, I think it's pretty rare that there isn't a best meaning. You know, so even if there are competing plausible meanings or meanings that, you know, kind of have something behind them, there's almost always one meaning that is better than the other. And I think after Loper Bright, you know, judges have to keep working hard to find that meaning and go in that direction. And that requires judgment sometimes, right? There are different sources of meaning, and how do you bring them all together to find the best meaning? I just think that's part of what judges have to do. So
I agree entirely with what fellow commentators have said. I would just add one other thought. Judge Easterbrook, a while back, wrote an article, I don't remember the title, dealing with this problem and pointing out if there is comes eventually, after all that hard work, a point where you cannot discern the meaning, what, then there's nothing there. Then you just stop. And to illustrate, think of the unfortunate Supreme Court understanding of the 10th Amendment. Essentially, it says it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing there. And it doesn't have any effect. And a statute has no effect if there's no meaning there. So one can't just stop and say, it means nothing.
It's a great article. Statutes, domains, yeah. Judge Easterbrook.
Thank you. So I ask this both of your academic expertise and extensive legislative experience. I've heard this idea discussed on several panels this week about, well, you know, post Loper Bright regulations could just be submitted as proposed legislation to Congress. So there's in political economy, there's a principle I variously called either the Lucas critique or Campbell's law, Goodhart's law, the idea that when you institute a change of the rules in an institution, you can't anticipate that the players will continue to play in the same way. People are going to adapt to the new rules, right? And once upon a time, things like regulations, when they were introduced, you know, what is now regulation, when it was introduced to the legislature, just got voted up as massive omnibus bills of special legislation. And so, you know, if that's where we are in 10 years, because it's probably unrealistic to assume fewer
questions.
Yeah, so yeah. If that's in 10 years from now, if that's where we are we really better off in that world, or are we just following a different, more cumbersome procedure to get to the same place?
That's a distinct possibility, I think, and that's really the underlying thesis of the paper I mentioned that I have forthcoming in the Administrative Law Review with Professor Walters. It's hard to know. Years ago, some sociologist wrote a book about the myths of nature, thinking about environmental risks and the cultural predispositions about environmental risk. And some people think that if you disrupt an ecosystem just a little bit, poof, you know, it disappears, it's unstable. And others think, no, you know, we can tolerate some pollution and the ecosystem, you know, adapts to it. And in this paper, Professor Walters and I draw a parallel. We even go so far as to suggest that there might be some myths of Loper Bright as to what we think it will actually mean for the administrative state may depend more on our background assumptions and cultural predispositions about how easy it is to shift this large governmental system that we have. And it may be that, yes, we're living in a time right now of what political scientists would call a disequilibrium, but political scientists also talk about punctuated equilibriums, where you have a system that experiences a shock but then settles back down into a new equilibrium. We don't know in 10 years whether that new equilibrium will be very much the same as it was before Loper Bright or not. That's why not having a crystal ball it's anybody's guess. I think that's an excellent point you make.
And could I just dissent and say, I mean, I think, you know, the idea is that there's a bunch of stuff that's done by legislation that Congress, you know, should use the regulation as a starting point and try to legislate. But I think it's completely wrong to think that Congress is just going to approve everything the regulators did, and come out in exactly the same place. And I think suggesting that sort of ignores some of the perniciousness of the administrative state, because, you know, no rational legislature is going to put higher burdens on small fisher people than they put on the largest commercial fishermen in the world. No rational legislature would have imposed a mandate to include all 20 forms of FDA-approved contraception in the Little Sisters of the Poor's health plan. I could go on and on, but there are things that no rational legislature would put the Maine lobsterman out of business. But all of those things are things that regulators did, because regulators are not remotely politically accountable. So I think if you take a sort of regulatory sort of, you know, effort to solve a problem, put it over into the legislature, you're not just going to get it passed lock, stock, and barrel. You're going to get adjustments that I think reflect accountability, political reality, and ultimately, I think, are better from a liberty perspective.
If I may just once again echo Paul's comments. One way you can think about Loper Bright is a great victory for religious liberty, right? Because the administrative state is populated by people who, by virtue of their educated status, tend to be more theologically liberal than the rest of the population. That's not to choose sides between the orthodox and the liberal, but the reality is that if you need a law that does not bear down on your religious beliefs, it's much better to talk to a congressman of a different religious view than anyone in the administrative state. So I agree entirely.
Over here. Okay.
So I would love to celebrate with my boss, Philip Hamburger, the victories.
Colleague, not boss. Thank you.
That we've had over the last year, but I'm an Eastern European, so I'm genetically a pessimist. So here's my question. A lot of the things, a lot of the wins that administrative state gets is through litigation and settlement, or raid and euthanasia, as happened to poor Peanut, as we learned yesterday. So I guess the question is there room in this new Civil Rights Act for additional two titles, one perhaps for fee shifting, because litigation is so expensive for non-Chevrons of the world, and two, is the next step really reconsidering qualified immunity. So when there is this raid that's not authorized, somebody is ultimately responsible.
I look forward to continuing conversations about this. Right, so qualified immunity is an interesting problem, and I think we have to begin with the misnomer qualified. It's unqualified immunity because this is class-based immunity. All officials without qualification categorically are protected. That's very odd in American law. That just doesn't make sense. And I think one thing we can do is distinguish between street officers and desk officers. If you sit behind a desk, you can consult a lawyer. There are very few moments when someone sitting behind a desk has to act without consulting a lawyer. And at that point, the justification for qualified immunity withers away. And without qualified immunity, without realistic opportunities for damages actions against officers, we can never defend civil liberties in this country. Because we're in the position when you have to get forward-looking relief, and which you often cannot get, as seen in Murphy, which is much too narrow as well, doesn't reach the whole class. But also, it doesn't really affect the incentives of anyone involved. They're not personally at stake. And so we really do need a revival of unqualified immunity. And the court has to distinguish different circumstances. I go on at length on this, but I'll spare you.
Question over here.
Good afternoon. Thank you for all being here. First, I'm from Maine, so on behalf of Maine, I feel like I need to say thank you for saving our lobster. And one of the things I love about this panel is you not only appreciate the constitutional protections, but you observe how they work out in real life. Many of you have observed how Congress has stopped congressing since all of the policymaking power has been deferred to the executive branch. I'm curious about your observations. Do you think we can go backwards? As these dominoes fall and less policymaking power is in agency discretion, are we already starting to, or is there hope that we'll get to a place where Congress starts legislating again and people will start looking to their congresspeople for solutions?
I hope so. I think for many of the reasons that Paul mentioned, lawmaking, in a collective Congress is just an inherently different activity from what it is that agencies do. And there's sort of a popular move in legal academia to say that the administrative state can promote constitutional values. And I don't really know what constitutional values are that are separate from the actual requirements of the Constitution, but I certainly don't think that the administrative state promotes them really in any way. So I do think as we kind of go back to that, I think Congress will have to do that. But I would also say there are a lot of interesting incentives for members of Congress. They can get a lot done through the administrative state. When they give open-ended delegations to agencies, it empowers them to get things done not through lawmaking, but through executive action. And that has, I think, been one of the fundamental ways one of the fundamental reasons why Congress has been so weakened over time.
I would concur that there's a lot of really important fundamental underlying difficulties with Congress acting, multiple veto gates in the legislative process. We have ideological polarization in Congress. We have the filibuster rule. These are really, I think, some of the most profound challenges to Congress acting and stepping forward. There is some initial research in the political science world, a paper by my co-author, but I'm not involved with it, Dan Walters again, who he looks at the standards of judicial review at the state level, where there is variation and sometimes even articulated in state codes, but also in state judicial decisions, whether courts are to adopt something like Chevron or Skidmore or de novo review, and at least at the state level finds that the legislatures where there's de novo review applicable actually are the less active. And he suggests maybe that's because the legislators, don't seem like they have a real interest in going forward and going through the laborious legislative process if it's if the implementation of that statute is only going to be given to some court somewhere who doesn't really know what they're trying to get at. I'm not sure we know the answer to this, but I do know that this is incredibly complex. The administrative governance game has multiple actors, and it's very hard to forecast where we're going to go.
Kai Alberg, Washington State. Professor Koglianis earlier alluded briefly to Auer. I'd like to ask the whole panel, what do you think is the future of the Auer doctrine after Loper-Bright?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, I already suggested this, I think it's hard to square retaining Auer, even in the form modified in Kaiser v. Wilkie, which, by the way, I think Kaiser v. Wilkie really just tracked how Chevron, properly conceived, was structured along the lines that I've written about in a paper called Chevron's Interstitial Steps. But it's hard to see how if the agency's interpretation of a statute by Congress doesn't merit deference, why the courts should give deference to the interpretations of the agency's own regulations, which is a kind of self-dealing or self-deference. So I think our deference, if I had to guess, is at least if the court on this view wants to be consistent, I think it's on the way out.
Yeah. Do we still have our deference?
We have. Well, the query, right?
Right. I think it is only ours to live, right?
The only thing I'd add with this is before Loper-Bright, many courts around the country, in part because of reasons already stated, you know, the federal government wasn't always advocating for Chevron deference. And I think a lot of courts started just trying to do the statutory interpretation. And I think that's the same thing that will happen with Kaiser, is they'll take it upon themselves to do that and not even get to the need to have any sort of deference at the back end.
Yeah, and on that point, there's a new paper by Nick Bednar at Minnesota, a political science and law professor, who finds that actually what the courts have been doing, he's got a sample of from 2012 and 2022, and in 2022, he's finding by that point in time, the courts are just really deciding even Chevron cases on step one grounds. Mm-hmm. But what he does find is that the agency is continuing to win, which is again, for those of us who want to see what the future lies, it may be that with Chevron gone, the agencies will still continue to win, but not because Chevron is being invoked, but because courts are agreeing with the agency for any number of reasons.
And just to offer a slightly different take on this, I mean, if you think about it just as a matter of doctrine, it doesn't make a lot of sense to continue to have Kaiser in a sort of post-Chevron world. But I guess I'm not sure I see which cases it's really going to make that much of a difference, because if ultimately the agency has to have statutory authority, if it gets to clarify its reg before it's tested against the statute, like, who really cares? They still have to have statutory authority. So I think that the step may just not matter that much in a post-Chevron world.
Can I just get back to Carrie's point on this very interesting observation that even with change, the agency tends to win? I think that this gets back to the qualified immunity question. One of the risks of our current regime for protecting civil liberties is that you have to have suits between, say, an individual and an agency. And in cases between individuals and government, the government usually does win. It has an advantage because judges of all stripes still tend to defer to the authority of government. They don't want to hold a government act unlawful. In contrast, under the older regime with which we lived in the 19th century and the 18th century, an individual who was injured would bring a suit against an individual in government, not as representative of the state, but as an individual who went awry. And then it's just between two individuals, and the judge does not have to hold against the government, but just against a wayward individual. That changes entirely the complexion of the suit and gives you a much better chance of winning. And so it's very important to at least pull back a little bit on qualified immunity, at least as to some administrative officers, because that changes one's opportunities in court. One has a much better chance of an equal decision-making process.
Can I add one more thing on the Kaiser? Probably the area, maybe this is another topic potentially for law review notes, that I see it the most frequently is in the sentencing guidelines. The application notes and commentary is frequently invoked by the probation office and also U.S. Attorney's Office. And it used to be called Stinson deference. The 11th Circuit now says basically it's been Kaiserized. So it has the same analysis. But that is a very frequent area. And I would be curious to see how courts handle that going forward. We're here.
Hi. This is somewhat of a more niche question, but we're talking about possible responses Congress can take to the growth or reduction of the administrative state. I can't remember which one of y'all mentioned the RAINS Act. Its progenitor, the Congressional Review Act. My understanding is it's adheres to bicameralism and presentment. They present to the president within 60 days for his signature. When I read the RAINS Act, I don't see any. I usually don't see a provision for actually presenting to the president. It seems to operate as just a legislative veto almost, which was struck down in INS Vichada back in the 80s. I was just wondering, if we manage to be the dog that catches the car and it gets passed, to what extent do you think it would withstand constitutional scrutiny on review?
Can I come in on this? I once, when I was young and foolish, went to Capitol Hill. I was much younger, and talked to some of the legislative aides who were handling the RAINS Act, and they were very nice, very learned, very smart. Perhaps some of them are here. And after 10 minutes conversation, I said, "But is this really constitutional?" And there was a look of. They didn't take special opinion, but there was a look of some doubt on their faces. And then I asked, and you don't expect this ever to pass, do you? And they said, no, of course not. And I think that says everything.
The question is a real one. I think the way the statute is structured, the agency's rule would not take effect unless both houses of Congress and the president approve. Now, you would expect the president to approve if the regulation came out of the president. Administration. So that's not an issue. Where the Chadha, I think, question arises is because the rule will not take effect unless both houses of Congress and the president approve, then if just one house of Congress doesn't approve, it's effectively like a one-house veto. That's the argument that I think would be made challenging it. And I think there's going to be a question about what the court would do in that case. I think one view would be formally, no, this is just sort of rejiggering what it takes for an agency, and not all agency rules, this only applies to a subset, but the rules that are covered can only take effect if there's this additional procedural hurdle. And it's essentially like saying agencies, when we've delegated you all this authority to create regulations, well, some of those delegations are now just to create proposed regulations or, double-layered proposed regulations, right? They've gone through the proposed rule and the final rule process, but they're not really final rules until Congress acts.
So one of the concerns about those that were for Chevron deference was that we need this agency expertise, and courts don't have the expertise to determine these complex questions that the agencies are designed to answer on the factual issues. But it seems to me that just as in any other litigation, you've got Rule 702, you've got Daubert, so let the agency put forth its expertise on the one side and the regulated party put forth its expertise on the other side, and the judge will act as its gatekeeper function, and the parties can file their Daubert motions, and then the court can evaluate the experts. Now, I've talked about this before, even put it in one of my amicus briefs, but I haven't heard anybody talking about this. Am I missing something? Why that's not a reasonable argument or view?
Are you talking about factual determinations or legal?
Well, one of the arguments for Chevron is that justices don't have the, I mean, Justice Sotomayor, I believe, said, well, wait a minute, what about how many parts per billion is it appropriate for this regulation of water? And so can a judge doesn't have expertise on that, but the agency does. So if the agency has that expertise, you need to defer to the agency on that factual issue. But why should they when, as Justice, one of the Kagan said before she was a justice, the agency is like a black box. We don't know what's going on in there. So why shouldn't they be subjected to their factual determinations on these technical issues be subjected to the same examination as any other litigant?
Well, I think what the Chief Justice said in Loper Bright was, if it's a question of what the statute means, that's a legal question because it's a matter of linguistics, and an agency or expert is not more suited to do that than a judge, but that there are still permissible delegations of facts finding for agencies to make.
Right. If I can just, I must say that I think expertise has taken a bit of a hit recently, right? and, you know, we could go COVID, regulation of fats versus sugar, mercury, fluoride. I can go in great detail on these, and it's very interesting and depressing. If you rely on government expertise, you will probably have children who are slightly damaged and so forth. And it gets actually to a larger question about the difference between expertise and science. The value of expertise rides on assumptions that it's scientific, but expertise is different from science, especially cutting-edge science. And agencies may have expertise, but what does that mean? It may mean out-of-date science, right? They don't have the expertise that, say, Musk has in building his rockets, as we see from the outputs. And you know, so expertise may be overrated. Put another way, if you understand what the agencies mean by expertise that justifies lawmaking, what they're talking about is science that is sufficiently well-known and grounded and stable that it justifies regulation. That's the very opposite of cutting-edge science. So in a number of ways, both empirically and theoretically, I think the value of expertise has diminished over the last few years, possibly.
Yeah, and I think the other reason maybe we haven't been talking about expertise quite as much is, you know, there are certain contexts where that argument is at least attractive, I mean, to the other side of me anyways, you know, that's an attractive argument. And some of the things you say about that are very fair points. But, you know, for every situation when there's like, you know, this really complicated, you know, necessary determination to figure out whether some particular substance is a hazardous substance within the meaning of some statute, for every one of those, there's another like nine cases that Chevron applied that had nothing to do with any kind of expertise in the normal sense. And so think about Loper Bright and Relentless. Like, what expert agency expertise do you need to figure out that when you run out of appropriated funds, it would be useful to tax the regulated? Like, that's not an expert agency judgment. That's just the way that government works if it's not checked. And, you know, what expertise does it say that to fulfill the women's health mandate, you need to mandate that all 20 forms of FDA-approved contraception should be required? I mean, you know, maybe the FDA's judgment about what works is a scientific judgment, but to say that every health plan in the country, including the Archdiocese of Pittsburgh and the Little Sisters of the Poor, needs to provide it is just the purest legislative judgment and has nothing to do with agency expertise. So I think, you know, if I were forced to defend Chevron, yeah, I would talk a lot about agency expertise, but that's only discusses a very small percentage of the cases where Chevron ended up shielding the agency action.
As a legal matter, you know, the expertise argument was just a throw in, I think, add on argument, policy argument in Chevron. The real legal basis for Chevron deference was an explicit or implicit delegation of authority to the agency. Arguably, Loper-Bright may preserve that. There's a couple of paragraphs where it's unclear. But one thing that Loper-Bright didn't touch at all is State Farm, Baltimore Gas and Electric, the hard look but deferential look that courts are to give to agencies' policy determinations under 706 and the arbitrary and capricious standard. That hasn't changed.
I think we have time for just one more question. Dana?
So this is actually a follow-up on what you guys have been discussing. So one of the problems for litigants representing individuals, perhaps particularly like not giant corporations, is the lack of adversarial fact-finding and the inability to get discovery, to like get the information that you might need to defend someone against an enforcement action. And yet there is deference, there's not adversarial. What is the future of that? Is that going to continue, or are there going to be ways, maybe under Jarkissi, where you're actually entitled to a little bit more?
Mr. Court Judge,
Well, I certainly think people are going to challenge it as that, especially if you look at Justice Gorsuch's opinion, where it's grounded also in Article 3 in due process, not just a Seventh Amendment. I think there are compelling reasons to think that they go hand in hand in terms of like the whole fairness of the procedure generally, like a jury trial right in front of a Article 3 judge with the attendant evidence gathering and whatnot. So I certainly expect that those will be forthcoming challenges.
And I would just add to come back full circle to, since I think we're wrapping up here, my initial comments about the ambiguities that exist going forward. Keep in mind that Jarkissi doesn't apply to all agency adjudications, but just to those where there's some sort of common law analog. It's unclear whether the public rights exception for Article I courts or administrative agency tribunals wholesale is eliminated. The public rights exception and Atlas Roofing is not really touched yet. It remains to be seen how far and how expansive that will be. But certainly if you're practicing in the securities law context, you now will have the option, your clients will have that adversarial process that of a Seventh Amendment jury trial right that Jarkissi protected.
Forgive me, but I think you are misunderestimating the extent of these cases. Loper-Bright, yes, is a statutory case, but Roberts wrote his opinion in a way that quite clearly alluded to the constitutional foundations. And as you would expect, he moves slowly, but that doesn't mean the principle isn't stated there and is part of the holding. And by the same token, in Jarkissi, yes, Atlas Roofing was not overturned, but the principle that private rights cases, and I don't like the private-public distinction, but if we're going to have it, because private rights cases belong in Article III courts, and he quotes Stern. So the underlying principles there are powerful, and I think that's the future.
Okay, if everyone could join me in thanking our panel.